Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see below the surface.
Mm-hmm. And we also talk about towns possessed by unspeakable evil.
Evil. Less often, but yes.
Less often.
We seem to talk about that a lot.
We need to have more podcasts about unspeakable evil.
It would be awfully quiet if we can't speak about the evil.
That's right. That's on the cover of my lovely, this has to be from the 70s, my paperback copy of Salem's Lot.
Got it.
First signet printing, August of 1976.
Ooh.
Yes.
Fancy.
It is fancy. But Salem's Lot by Stephen King. I read this book. I read it really early. It must have been 7th or 8th grade, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what's funny? I was thinking about it the other day. I even called up some clips of the, there was a Tobe Hooper miniseries called Salem's Lot back when. And I remember being at a friend's house and watching that. It's like one of those flashbulb memories. And the reason that it made me chuckle is because last episode we talked about Monty Python's Life of Brian. I remember that very same night is the first time I ever saw Monty Python.
Wow.
So it was Monty Python it was the half hour show, Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the beans episode. Beans. Somebody was screaming for beans. And,
I don't remember it.
Yeah, it's not one of the good episodes, but,
oh, okay.
But, somehow that caught me, but, what a night that was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Two cultural icons right there.
That's
and
right.
What are the odds that I would pick that and then you pick this?
Mm-hmm.
Someone's trying to get you to think back to your past, Scott.
Perhaps.
Think back.
Thinking.
Well, the good stuff, I guess.
Yes, the good stuff. But then, I think I read it after that. I can't recall if I read it before or after, but this is one of those books that just looms large in my reading memory as well.
Well, I mentioned a couple of episodes before as an aside that I was checking this out of the library because I don't happen to have a copy anymore. And a much younger woman was waxing enthusiastic. Oh my gosh, that's the first horror novel I ever read. It's the best one ever written. And you know, so, it still looms large. And I was looking at it, 1975, I would have been plenty old to read it, but I don't think I did. I think I read Carrie afterward, though. I think this is probably the first Stephen King book I ever read. I probably, you know what? I might have read this pretty close to when it came out.
Yeah, it's for certain the first Stephen King I ever read,
mm-hmm.
followed closely by The Stand, I believe. I read The Stand before I read The Shining. but I didn't read it in 1976. I would have been too young.
Well,
I would have been wee. I was wee.
When I was in 1975, I was a senior in high school. So
I was wee. But not.
Yeah. Full confessions here. I was not. And yet, for everyone who wasn't,
yes.
We then were still cool.
That's right. Now, that's right.
We're still talking about this. Yeah, because I remember I read Carrie before the movie, but I was never a fan of that book or the movie that much. Although it was interesting, you know, my mom and I went to see it together, which goes along with the fact that I'm going to go see my mom next week and we're going to watch horror movies for 3 days.
Oh, wow.
Us and my oldest daughter. So she was pretty excited to hear we were doing Salem's Lot, though she doesn't listen, but
that's
she approved
nice.
Of the subject matter.
So what do you think it is about Stephen King 100 books later? Not that we've read the 100 books, but I've read, I would say, most of them. What is it about Stephen King that you like or dislike? Do you like him? Do you, when you see something new from him, do you want to read it or is that past?
No, that's past because after I read Cujo, which broke my heart, but I didn't feel like it was that great of a book to see. I mean, no, I got through it.
Yeah.
But the last line of Cujo broke my heart. He always wanted to be a good dog.
Oh, boy.
And then I read Christine, which was like, to me, like The Shining, but with a car. And then I read It. And I got done with It, and I said, I can't believe I slogged through all these pages, and it was so derivative to me of a lot of the other stuff he'd done. Oh, and I also read The Tommyknockers, which was just nothing but depressing. And so he disappointed me for so many books in a row that I finally said, I don't need to read this anymore. And then I did pick up The Cell recently, whenever it came out. It sounded like an interesting premise, and I was so angry at the ending, which was kind of a non-ending, that I said, well, that was his chance. Nope.
Yeah. Well, I've read a lot of Stephen King, mostly because of my enjoyment of audiobooks.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen King always had the best audiobooks. Even when audiobooks were brand new, you know, the readers and everything were always top notch. And, I hadn't read Stephen King in print for a long time, but some of his later stuff I liked. I liked Bag of Bones.
Okay.
Cell, I didn't really think too much of Cell. I liked Desperation.
You've mentioned that one. Yeah.
And I mentioned that one because God plays a role in it, as he does in this book too, right? Mm-hmm. But I like Stephen King, and I think that the reason that I like him the most is because, you know, if you read this book for as a vampire book, you probably want to go ahead and start on page 180 or so. You know, because it takes about that long for it to get rolling as a vampire book. But the first half of it is really about, you know, it's about a small town. It's about the people. I was struck this time through it at the negative aspects of everyone that he was showing. You know, he would have these asides and saying, okay, in Salem's Lot, this is going on right now. And it would be like a chapter worth. And it was just, you know, horrible thing after horrible thing before the vampires ever showed up. It was like, these are people just, you know, being horrible, often.
I noticed he did not seem to have a lot of good people in it. There were a few good people speaking along those lines. And then there were a lot of people who were doing things that were terrible, you know. Also, at this point in his career, I don't know if he's fixed this, but what was it with him and people's mothers?
I didn't notice that. What do you mean?
Well, I was thinking of Fran's mother in The Stand, and she's so awful, you know. And then Susan's mother in this is horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't argue with either of those.
They were the same kind of person. I felt like they were the same character. Hmm. They wanted to control their kid. Nothing their kid did was right. I know how you should live. The choices you make are horrible.
Right, and she was trying to steer him toward a guy that she did not like. Yeah,
and the father couldn't really say much. He just kind of had to work behind the scenes in both cases, and maybe that's because Salem's Lot, you could see a lot of foreshadowing of what he was going to do with The Stand and The Shining.
Yeah, it is nice to read this in light of The Stand, because it sort of has the same structure, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, big evil thing, and these, you could call them chosen people or not, but a group of people come together in order to fight it.
Yeah, for the good of everyone.
Right, yeah.
I'm sorry, I got you off of what you like and what you don't like. But I was going to say also that one of the things he does so well is he can capture the spirit of modern culture. I think that's why people like to read him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he said, he's never going to be the French meal. He's the McDonald's, and he knows it. but he does that so well. I mean, he makes a great hamburger.
Yeah.
And that little town that you're talking about, all those things that people are doing, I don't know if I would agree with the proportion of evil that he's showing, but that's the kind of stuff people are doing behind closed doors.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, I'd like to think there were more loving families like Mark's family and that kind of thing, but you've got overbearing parents. You've got, like Susan had, you have, you know, people who are beating their baby. You have all these various things. You have the priest who's the drunk. Well, that's, you know, and trying to hide it. And those are all the failings that everybody has. And he also is really good at celebrating the good stuff, the joy of going somewhere to get an ice cream cone. You know, when he was writing stuff about the little park, sitting in the little park eating ice cream, you know, I kind of went, oh, man, it's been a long time since I've done anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he captures those well, and he can. He doesn't do it a lot in this book especially, but he really can paint a scene so you feel like you're there, and you probably really experienced it since you were listening. I was terrified to listen because I know Stephen King is going to get pretty visceral sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, in fact, the only part that I had to, I was like, boy, should I skip this, was the that baby part that you mentioned already.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, no, I really don't want to hear this. And luckily it was very short. But yeah, but you're right. Those things do happen. And they are horrible.
And he captured the poignancy of it because that young mother would just let her frustration overcome her, and she'd hit the baby, and then she'd be sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And the baby, this is just, you know, a heartbreaker, but that's how it is. It's a heartbreaker. You know, the baby's screaming and holding his hands up in front of his face because he's 10 months old, but then he's smiling at her after because she says, mommy, you know. And so that's what pulls your heartstrings.
Right.
Because he captures those human elements so well.
And he does. And his characters are just so familiar. You know, we know people like this, you know, whether it be, you know, the real estate agent or Ben Mears, even Susan, you know, Mark Petrie, you know, I probably would have been Mark Petrie. Not as brave as him though.
Yeah. Way to me go. Too, but way not to go, smart Mark. Enough to try to take that bully down at the beginning.
Yeah. That's funny.
But so, he also, go ahead.
No, I was just going to start getting into the book a little bit.
Yeah, no, I was going to say the other thing he does, though, is he spins a tale that just grabs you by the throat and you can't quit.
Yeah.
And that's what he combines with this knowledge of Americana.
Yeah, and I think it's that way with the books of his that I do like. You know, there's always the horror in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if I didn't care about the rest of it, the horror is usually secondary.
Yeah.
It is secondary in his books, although it's how he sells books or why people often want to buy them. But I don't know that all the readers, you know, it just wouldn't matter that much about the vampires unless it was Mark Petrie and Ben Mears and Susan and these
Father
people,
Callahan
Father
and,
Callahan,
yeah.
That matters. And that's what he does.
And Jimmy, Dr. Jimmy.
That's right.
I'd completely forgotten
and
him.
And Matt.
And Matt. Yes, I'd forgotten everybody. I mean, I'd forgotten, you know, a couple of those people. So, but I realized how much I had reread it because I could remember big swatches of this book.
That's cool. So this would be my third time through it. And like you mentioned, this time I listened to it. And it was excellent. I think Ron McLarty is the narrator. But fantastic.
Yeah, I listened
really
to the
good.
Beginning. But then I remembered what was coming. And I went, well, no, sorry. I'll just have to enjoy you on a different book.
I don't think so. Yeah, Ron McLarty. I just verified it. So it's on Audible. So you mentioned the beginning. This scene, I just love this scene at the beginning. It's during the prologue. Mm. You've got Mark Petrie and Ben Mears are in Mexico.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to read just a little bit. They're talking to a priest, and there's a translator there. And the translator says, he says there are strange things in the world. 40 years ago, a peasant from El Graniones, I guess, brought him a lizard that screamed as though it were a woman. He has seen a man with stigmata, the marks of our Lord's passion, and this man bled from his hands and feet on Good Friday. He says this is an awful thing, a dark thing. It is serious for you and the boy, particularly for the boy. It is eating him up, he says. And the priest spoke again briefly. He asks if you understand what you have done in this new Jerusalem. Jerusalem's lot, the tall man said. Yes, I understand. Grasson spoke again. He asks what you intend to do about it. The tall man shook his head very slowly. I don't know. And the priest spoke again. He says he will pray for you. And that's the end of that section. And it's just like, there's a, I don't know, there's like hope and hopelessness there at the same time. It's like you have a huge responsibility because of what you were just involved with.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't know what I'm going to do about it. And the priest says, well, I'm going to pray for you. Hope you figure it out.
And at that point, none of us know anything about that.
Right. We don't we don't know why he's left or what right. exactly happened. All we know is that they're running.
Well, and if I can read just one little paragraph from the very beginning, this is the section called Susan, but it's just a little description. He turned onto Railroad Street, popped off the headlights, and turned into the small dirt parking lot which served the rooming house. The back porch was painted white with red trim, and three wicker chairs lined up on it looked toward the Royal River. The river itself was a dazzling dream. There was a late summer moon caught in the trees on the river's far bank, three quarters full, and it had painted a silver path across the water. With the town silent, she could hear the faint foaming sound as water spilled down the sluiceways of the dam.
Hmm.
And I just felt like I was there. I mean, I could hear that water, and you know how the moon is on the water when it's really dark like that. And
yeah, it's neat to live in a town that can be that quiet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I did live in the country for a good part of my high school years, at least. Yeah. So.
Yep, and I lived there, too, for a long time.
Right.
Not in the same place as you, but another place. Nope.
Right.
But right. But yeah, that is something. When you move away from that environment, it's when you notice it. And you're like, mm-hmm. wow, everything's so busy.
Yeah.
And everybody's in a hurry.
Yeah, the lights never turn out.
Right. So the main character is Ben Mears. And he's a writer who has come to Jerusalem's Lot. Which Salem's Lot is just short for Jerusalem's Lot. He's come there to write his next novel, and he's staying at a boarding house. And there's a house, the Marston House, which he had an experience of when he was young that has just stuck with him. And he's writing a book about that. He doesn't like to talk about the book very much because he's still writing it. But then he meets Susan. And they fall in love, and then you've got people throughout Salem's Lot that they all kind of start off separately, and then their lives start to intertwine, and they're meeting each other as this horror starts. And the horror begins when this guy shows up in town and wants to open an antique shop, and he's visiting the real estate a real estate agent in town, and he's bought the Marston House. And anyway, from there, you know, that's the beginning of it. I guess I'm not sure how much farther to go into it at this point, but
yeah,
is that a decent description without even mentioning vampires yet, really?
I know. Well, and I think you could have called the house Marston House, Marston House, really, in a sense, because it's described as looming over the town, and people tend to look at it when they're just kind of hanging out. Their gaze is drawn by it. Ben Mears is haunted by it because of that experience, that kind of a psychic supernatural experience he had when he was a kid. And when the lights go on, because it's been bought, everybody kind of freaks out a little. Oh my gosh, there's a light on there.
Somebody's up there. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's this looming force that Stephen King then starts talking about. I think maybe there are psychic experiences that can sink into a house and make the house itself evil, or draws evil to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the psychic center that everybody kind of thinks about when things start getting weird in the town. And then, yeah, this book kind of follows, in a sense, not exactly, Dracula. And you told me, I believe, that he said it was – well, actually, I guess I heard it in the foreword of the audiobook that Stephen King read Dracula and then wanted to do an American Dracula, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Without calling this
not exactly
this evil Dracula, but you're exactly yeah. right. It's him thinking, okay, what would Dracula be like in the modern day?
Mm-hmm.
And modern day being 1975, and there's a lot of, you know, I recently read The Judge's House by Bram Stoker,
yes.
which is also mentioned in the introduction. Mm-hmm. And there's also this kind of a Catholic thing in that, you know, like when he throws a Bible at a rat or something. Yeah. So, you know, Stoker's the whole Catholic Church power over evil type of a thing is all over in this book. And as it was in Dracula, I believe, and I don't have mm-hmm. good memories of Dracula if I've even read the whole thing. So is that a big part of the book?
Because Van Helsing, who's the main vampire hunter in Dracula, he's a Protestant, but he's good buddies with, I can't remember if it's the Vatican or this high up bishop or somebody who supplies him with consecrated host.
Mm.
So that when they're having to deal with Lucy or the undead or anything like that.
So,
takes holy water and sprinkles it around, and then he puts pieces of the wafer around the, you know, tomb and that kind of thing.
Interesting, because that happens in this book too. They're,
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to assume now that we're in spoiler territory. I think it's a decent description, you know, vampire book from here on out.
Yeah, because basically the little group of people who are clued in and manage to make themselves believe that something like that's happening these days, which wasn't such a problem back then. And although even in the Dracula book, it's kind of ridiculous once you're in London. People just think that's crazy. But they come together to fight with the best tools they can. And it made me think of Roger Ebert's quote that I love, and he would always say he was Catholic, except for the fact that he didn't believe in God, but he was so into the Catholic Church that, except for that. And he would say, you know, I guess he watched a vampire movie, and he said, you know, the great thing about being Catholic is we have got all the tools. If it comes down to vampires, they're not going to a Lutheran minister. They're coming to the Catholic priest, and they're getting the wafer and the crucifix, and that's what this book does, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, and the priests, you know. But yeah, so in this book, there is a lot of, you know, we need to get some of the consecrated hosts, and we need to do this. And so that must be where they got it. I didn't remember that from Dracula. But, you know, I know the garlic and the holy water and all that stuff. And
certain kinds of wood that can be used for the stake. I was interested to notice they had that. There are a few things that I did just from the top of my head that are different is, I was really surprised. Craftlit, actually, Heather Ord over at Craftlit did an audio version of Dracula where she did commentary, which was wonderful, but also she got all these people to consistently record the different epistolary pieces.
Oh, cool.
And so the person who did Van Helsing, who was very modern, so he recorded his journal onto a gramophone record. He always had a little hiss in the background. I mean, it was really great.
Neat.
Everybody who did this. So if you want to listen to it, that's a wonderful, wonderful version.
Cool.
But one of the things I was surprised at was Dracula, they see him one day, he's going to the bank during the day.
Mm.
He's out in the daylight. It doesn't bother him. And he also doesn't have a dark master. But I think this shows in Stephen King when his vampire does have a master who a child has to be sacrificed to before he can even come to the town. And that's part of Stephen King's fascination with that real traditional look at how does good and evil, how do they battle?
Hmm.
What do they require?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So now Barlow was the vampire.
Yeah.
And the other guy was not a vampire.
Straker. Like Renfield.
Yeah, yeah. He was like the familiar or whatever you'd call it.
You think, why would anyone do that, really?
I don't know why anyone would do that. Especially when you saw his end. I mean,
oh,
you know,
man.
Yeah, when.
Well, yeah, but here's what I
like. It's like, yeah, I'm going to throw you out now because I'm done. Yeah. I'm done with you.
Yeah, what I like is the vampire's up against the ropes. Straker has not, he's been hurt. He's been wounded, I guess, severely while Mark is getting away. And so what does he do? He sucks him dry and then blames everybody else and is mad at them because it's their fault. And I'm like, really? Is this pure evil? You can't do better than this.
Yeah.
Own it, man.
That's right. That's right.
But that kind of makes me think of one of the things I thought was really interesting about the technique that we see the vampire use in this book to get people who are kind of going, whoa, I don't know who this guy with the red eyes is, but I have to get out of here. There's a little voice going, leave, leave now, don't listen. But what he would always do is bring up things about their personal relationships with other people that were grudges or things that they hated, that they felt they were being hated in. And that would, that hate would suddenly make them receptive because he'd promise, we'll get even with everybody you ever hated. Ooh, okay. And yeah, they'd just kind of sink into his eyes and it would all be wonderful.
Right, right.
And I thought, what an interesting look at the first big step into evil is that King is looking at is give in to wanting to hate other people. Don't try to be better.
I'm thinking of Star Wars. Give in to the hate.
Well, there are some basic themes here. We can't deny it.
That's right. The other thing about the vampires is that they were attractive. I mean, they weren't, but somehow the people would react in a way as if they were attractive.
Yeah.
And that's a thing about evil, too. Mm-hmm. It's like if you can look at it with your real eyes, you'll see what it is. But somehow we don't. And that's the effect that the vampires had on their victims often as well.
Good point. I didn't even think that.
Well, gosh.
Well, I didn't mean it like that. I'm like, so smart.
Oh, geez.
Like that. Yeah. Well, and because the other thing I like about that concept of how it's almost hypnotic attraction that, mm-hmm. you know, there's the little voice going, don't do it, don't do it. But they do it anyway. They look at them. Is the one person that we see that I can think of who really effectively on his own fights the vampire is a 10 or 12 year, I guess he's 12 maybe, Mark Petrie.
Yeah.
Or Petrie.
I always felt like he was older, but you could be right that he was 12. I didn't catch his age. He just felt older than 12 to me. But
I just felt like if Danny and Ralph Glick were going to go play with him, and mm-hmm. I don't know what age group it was on the playground, but I didn't feel like that was the kind of confrontation that older kids really have.
Yeah, yeah, and that's true. You know, I thought part of why Mark was so compelling, I thought, is because he didn't have the I can't believe this thing, you know, wall.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, he was just like, well, holy crap, these are vampires and I know what to do about these guys. You know, the adults are like, okay, let's think about this for a second. How could this possibly be? And they got to exhaust everything, but he's like, no, that guy at my window, that doesn't have any explanation.
Floating two stories in the air with the sharp incisors telling me to open the window.
Yeah.
You invited me in. You invited me over.
Yeah. And, you know, that's interesting, too. What about this invite me in thing? Is that a Dracula from mm-hmm. Dracula as well? Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that once they'd been attracted in any level, they would like get up and open the window in their sleep.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Sort of thing. There's a whole really interesting section where this girl, Lucy, nobody knows what's going on until Van Helsing gets there. But she's getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And she they'll find the window open all the time because he was a bat. And that's how he got in.
Wow.
But they would have locked it up. The night air must be bad for her.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the most chilling scenes to me is when Matt Burke, who is a teacher, who is, you know, one probably the oldest guy in the book, who also comes to the conclusion quickly.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's downstairs and he had a friend of his upstairs who he was helping, and his friend died. And the ambulance came and got him. And he's by this point, other things had happened. So he had come to this conclusion, and then he's sitting downstairs in his house and he hears the window upstairs open and then he hears yeah. like a thud and then goes upstairs to investigate. And it was Mike Ryerson rocking in a chair, being a vampire.
That was after he had Susan come over to be his backup.
Yeah. Yeah. And Susan is downstairs. You know, he says, wait here.
Yeah. Don't let us go up there. Yeah. Well, I know, because he was the one who had the presence of mind to say, I revoke my invitation.
Yeah. And he said that
to the vampire.
What was, yeah. yeah, Mike Ryerson. And he got thrown out.
But that's also the point where you start to see the use of the sacraments or sacramentals.
Yeah, because he pulls a crucifix and
and uses the crucifix. And then when he tells them to go get the priest, you know, they've got the holy water, and he makes the people who are going to, because he's had a heart attack, so he's in the hospital kind of directing everything.
Yeah.
And he tells them to go to see the priest, tell him everything, and then everybody go to confession.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's really interesting, because none of them are Catholic.
Right. And Matt wasn't either, was he?
No, it was his mother's crucifix. He was, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and he said, but you've got to be as pure as possible and then do all these other things, you know, like, you know, garlic and all this sort of stuff. But,
that was a neat scene when Ben Mears went to confession.
That's what I was thinking of, is there are points in the book where Stephen King stops and he starts thinking about the Catholic Church. And I didn't remember that specifically, because the last time I read this was a long time ago, and I wasn't Catholic, that's for sure. And so when Matt tells them to go to confession, I'm like, oh, I didn't even remember that. And then they're in the confessional, and the priest has been musing earlier about how the old kind of are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I just hear this.
It's noise. It's this book.
Oh.
Yep. I'm reading a book while we're podcasting.
And pretty fast too. I'm very full of admiration.
Yeah.
But he's been talking about there's this modern version of evil that's so much less powerful than the old school evil of the monsters, and he really wanted to fight the old evil, and of course here's his chance. And so you see it through his eyes, but then when Matt goes in, it says he felt helpless in the grip of this alien ritual, out of joint with his time. The confessional might have been a direct pipeline to the days when werewolves and incubi and witches were an accepted part of the outer darkness, and the church the only beacon of light. For the first time in his life, he felt the slow, terrible beat and swell of the ages, and saw his life as a dim and glimmering spark in an edifice which, if seen clearly, might drive all men mad. Matt had not told them of Father Callahan's conception of his church as a force, with a capital F, but Ben would have understood that now. He could feel the force in this fetid little box beating in on him, leaving him naked and contemptible. He felt it as no Catholic raised to confession since earliest childhood could have. And I'm like, I have to say, the other thing is, you know, he may feel naked and contemptible, but the church never feels like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, you could certainly, you know, we've talked several times on this podcast about, you know, things that make you feel a certain way. You know, everybody says, you know, you should feel a certain way about this. But I could read that exact description of the church and feel comforted as if it was like a rock, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Through the ages, it's here all the time. And, you know, I don't feel that the sacraments are ancient, or they are ancient, but they're not irrelevant.
No, but they're absolutely current.
Yeah, yeah.
In my life,
timeless, absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
But I loved that, the slow, terrible beat and swell of the ages.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about, and saw his life as a dim and glimmering spark in an edifice, which if seen clearly might drive all men mad. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of homage to be giving to the Catholic Church.
It is.
You don't expect that from a horror novel. Because he's giving good a real power that we don't tend to give it these days. And it meshed up for me with the scene at the end, which I really didn't remember either, where Ben is chopping at the door to the root cellar with the axe. And I don't know about you, but I could hear martial music. Like, oh, this is happening. And blue fire is going down the axe handle and spreading up his arms. And he's covered with fire. And it says, Mark saw without knowing or having to know that the possession was not in the least Christian. The good was more elemental, less refined. It was ore, like something coughed up out of the ground in naked chunks. There was nothing finished about it. It was force, capital F. It was power, capital P. It was whatever moved the greatest wheels of the universe.
Wow. Yeah.
And I thought, yeah. And he said, not in the least Christian. It was more elemental and less refined. And I'm like, yeah, so is that the part where if we saw the church really without our blinders on, we couldn't take it in our human form in a sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Right, right. Yeah, that is powerful.
Yeah, and it's whatever moved the greatest wheels of the universe. And I'm like, and it's clearly good because it is there specifically because he is so committed to fighting this evil until he falls.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah. That's cool. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can say I didn't remember that specific stuff either. You know, I remembered Father Callahan, but I didn't remember, you know, it's funny when you read a book at different stages in your life. Like I said, this is my third time through it. The previous time was when the audiobook was released. I don't know exactly when that was, but I'm going to guess 5-6 years. But even now, you know, who I am now is different than who I was then. And,
right.
You know, you're reading this stuff, with a whole different eyes and yeah, it's wonderful.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. And the whole thing about the sacraments and the church too, that I want to, if I could swing back for a second, is when you mentioned the priest here. So here's Ben, he doesn't believe in any of this stuff, but he's being lent the power, the grace, whatever, that he needs to do this job. And when he's using the cross made out of the two popsicle sticks or whatever and the tape, when they're in the morgue, it's glowing and it's working, you know. And because they'd said the prayer over it. Well, then you've got Father Callahan, who is able to use, you know, a crucifix and the various things against the vampire. And then the vampire starts talking to him at a different time and says, oh, well, those things only work if you really have pure faith. Otherwise, it's nothing. And everything goes out.
Wasn't Ben the guy, as he was making that crucifix with the popsicle sticks, he started to say a psalm as if it just came to him, right? Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me.
And Jimmy was doing it. The doctor was doing it with him.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten that.
Yep. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. So it's as if this was deep inside him.
Yeah.
You know, because it was a prayer, but it surprised him when it came out. As if it was so deep, it just kind of flowed from him once he started.
Yeah. I hadn't connected that with, and also, which makes me think of what happens to Mark when Straker has captured him and he's taking him upstairs. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, suddenly his thoughts started flickering with speed. And it says it was like he was a light bulb that's gotten a surge of power from no known source. And he can see the three things that he might do in that situation and the three different outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah. And see, isn't that cool? And that is almost, like you said, a precursor to the stand in which people are guided that way a little bit.
Yeah.
And I really think people are guided that way because I've been guided that way. I feel,
I know, right?
You know, at certain times in your life where you can listen and you feel that something's going on. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also desperation. And I know I've mentioned that. I mentioned it earlier, but in desperation, it's also like that.
Oh, you're going to make me read that book.
Well, someday. I don't know.
No, I don't mean you'll make me. I just mean you keep talking about it. I'm going to get
it. Yeah, but it's one of, you know, it's just a Stephen King novel. it's almost an attempt to say, you know, this is what the world is like with God in it. You know what I mean? There's evil and there's God. And that's kind of like what The Stand is, right?
Yeah.
And what this is too.
Yeah, this just has the evil. Well, because there are the people who are definitely not very good, a lot of them. And then there's the personified evil of the vampire.
Yeah.
And the thing that's so admirable about this little band of people, they don't quit.
Yeah.
They keep going. Yeah. I mean, even when Ben and Mark run away, it's just simply because they're overnumbered and they've got to regroup. I mean, they're not thinking necessarily about regrouping. They're just running, and so they run to Mexico, but they're still reading the papers, keeping an eye on things.
And they do. And they do. Have to go after back. It's all over, they do go back.
Yeah.
Which is just, what are you doing?
Crazy, right?
Yeah. It's like, come on. Yeah. But it's like they have a responsibility and they can't let it go.
It's the greater good. They can't let that happen and spread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so the thing about the sacraments, though, is it's interesting because I'm sorry to keep coming back to it.
No.
Because the thing that irritated me was that when the priest was like, oh, my gosh, you're right. Everything goes out. You know, his cross goes out. It doesn't work anymore. The power leaves him. And I'm like, that's wrong. I mean, I guess that crucifix isn't a sacrament. But
But that
would be the Eucharist would be a sacrament or.
Yeah.
But those things don't lose their blessedness as a sign of God's visible grace just because someone doesn't believe in them.
Yeah. And that's a tough thing, you know, without getting, you know, we could get in a really long conversation about what faith is. Right. But, you know, Father Callahan saw plenty up to that point.
Yeah.
To remove any doubt whatsoever. You know, he had put his fingers in the side of Jesus by that point.
Mm-hmm.
And how could he still be doubting at all? You know, so that's one thing. But you're also right that, you know, the crucifix's power does not come from a person. You know, not me or you. I mean, it does come from a person, the person of Jesus Christ. But it's not the person, you know.
It's not because we believe it that gives it its power.
Right. And that's the same thing with the sacraments. It's not the priest that gives any of that power.
Right.
You know, it comes from somewhere else.
Now that we're talking about it, I do realize he broke the promise that he said he'd give.
Mm-hmm.
If he let Mark go, he would drop his cross.
Oh.
And he didn't.
Yes.
So now I'm thinking...
Maybe that was
the value. Yeah. This is the value of talking it through is that, although because that cross isn't actually a sacrament, it's sacramental, which is a different, you know, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
But this little speech that Barlow gives about, you know, you've forgotten the doctrine of your own church. Is it not so? The cross, the bread and wine, the confessional, only symbols. Without faith, the cross is only wood, the bread baked wheat, the wine sour grapes. But that's a lie.
And this guy is
the father of lies. Mm-hmm. I mean, or the son of the father of lies. I guess the father of lies is his master.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, Father Callahan, maybe he listened to that. He's like, maybe I'm not strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Oh, you know, and that thing where he makes him drink his blood, that's also from Dracula.
Oh, okay.
You need to reread that book.
I'm gonna maybe try and get it done before Halloween because that's what I do.
You power read horror.
Yeah.
I like it. Well, because you're so sorry for him, Callahan, Father Callahan, when, you know, he's leaving, he tries to go into the church and it won't let him in because he's unclean. And I'm like, well, see, that's super effective for the book. But I was just like, I get what you're doing, but you know that's wrong too.
Well, do you happen to have marked that spot where Ben comes out of the confessional?
Oh yeah, I think. Hold on,
because I don't have it marked. I was flipping through looking for it, but you know, I listened to the audiobook. But
just one second,
he considers what has just happened, and I thought that was really good.
Yeah, I have it. Just one. Let me find it. Come on. Okay, let's see. Where he says, you're not done yet, you mean?
Yeah, so he says, you're not done yet. And then, because Ben got up and walked out because he thought he was finished, and the priest comes out and says, oh, we're not done. You have penance.
So Ben
comes back in, and then he gives him that. But then when he leaves then, he considers what he just did. There's like a paragraph.
Oh, well. That's not in my, unless it's in a different section.
Okay. Shoot. I'm not going to be able to find it, but.
Well, he just says, Matt was right when he said it was going to be harder than we thought. We're going to sweat blood before this is over, but it doesn't, that's interesting. I wonder if there's a revised version that,
this would be older. I mean, I've got the older one, but it would surprise me if anything was different.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm remembering it incorrectly, but I remember after that he came out and he thought for a minute. Maybe it was right before Callahan said, you're not finished.
Well, that's when he said he felt it as no Catholic raised to confession since the earliest childhood could have. But after that, he's just
okay.
He gives him a card and
maybe that was it and my thoughts made it longer or whatever.
Well, there was a whole lot before it that I didn't read. There was a long paragraph where he says, just to summarize, that he didn't have this sense of catharsis. And this is the thing my husband always tells me. He's like, I know you seem to love confession. You come out and you feel great. He goes, I don't feel anything. I don't like having to say that stuff out loud. I just come out and I just trust that it's done. And they, you know, everything works the way they say.
Right.
And so it says he just felt the dull embarrassment that went with telling a stranger the mean secrets of his life. Oh, maybe this is what you're thinking. Yet he could see how this ritual could become compulsive.
Yeah, yeah.
There was as bitterly compelling as strained rubbing alcohol for the chronic drinker or the pictures behind the loose board in the bathroom for an adolescent boy. There was something medieval about it, something accursed, a ritual act of regurgitation. Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah, pretty much. But my point in bringing it up is because, you know, we believe that the sacrament is an outward and visible sign.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
But of an inward grace.
Confession is sacrament.
So we believe that there is an actual spiritual happening.
Yeah.
And what is visible is the outward sign of that actual thing that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, you know, when, you know, Barlow or whatever says it's a symbol, you know, we don't believe it's a symbol. We believe that it's a sign of something real.
Right.
So, but I felt that Ben had experienced that. He knew something happened. He came out of it different than when he went in.
Yeah, that was, to me, that whole thing about the force.
Uh-huh.
Where he felt like, you know, that he could feel the force in that little box beating in on him.
Right, right.
And
so
then,
yeah, so I liked that very much. I just that's all. I wish I had marked it or something, but I'm sure that my mind just ran with it.
Well, if we find it, we'll put it in the show notes. Everyone can go read it and comment.
Yeah.
Well, and I hadn't connected those two things. That's a good point because he's the non-Catholic, but he goes through with it.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have to believe it. It's, you know, he's doing it for that reason, for purity. And the priest, who has been longing to fight evil face to face, comes up against it. And when it's that fatal hesitation of thinking too much, it's kind of that modern thing of where it said when Mark Petrie is grabbing the cross out of his, you know, monster toys on the table to hold up to the vampire who's trying to get him.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, if an adult had stopped, and it would have been fatal because they would have stopped and thought for a second too long.
Right. This is just a toy.
And it wouldn't have mattered. But he does it and it works. And so here's Ben, almost like Mark, where it's, and that's possibly why he's so full of grace at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But the connection between him and Father Callahan, who's like, I believe it, I'm going to do it. And then he stops and he thinks too much for a second and the vampire gets in with his lies.
Right.
And essentially turns him against himself, I guess.
Yeah.
He lets
him live and off he walks. Pretty miserable from then on.
Full of shame. I know. And I was just, I was like, they don't tell us any more of his story, but I was like, go see another priest. Come on, don't stop now.
Wow. Yeah.
I didn't mean to go on about sacraments so long.
No,
there were other things you wanted to talk about.
I just really loved, you know, just like in The Stand, it's like, you know, Mark and Ben and Jimmy and Matt, and Susan, right. When they come together and they start to fight, it's almost as if, you know, geez, I want to be worthy to fight, you know, I want to be one of these people, you know, and it's not that they're all perfect human beings, but they react correctly against evil.
Yeah, it's inspiring.
It is inspiring. That's yeah. See, and you said in one word what it took me like 10 minutes to say.
But I wouldn't have come up with that word if you hadn't said all that stuff.
But right.
We're a team.
Exactly. We're together. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
But that's exactly the perfect word. It's right.
Now, we had just very briefly before this started, we had talked about something that I thought you were making some good points about, where I was saying that the priest had a really interesting train of thought about how modern thinking, and especially Freud, had reduced the classic evils that man thought of them, from being supernatural evil to being humdrum.
Yeah,
and he kind of felt like it turned the modern church into a place that said God is dead.
Yeah, yeah. Right, and there's, I mentioned Peter Johnson.
Yeah.
Paul Johnson, I'm sorry. Paul Johnson's book called Modern Times. And in that book, in the very first chapter, he talks about what was the major influence on the thought of the 20th century. And Freud was one of them. And he talked about how he's removing responsibility, you know, so that the people don't feel as responsible for their actions anymore. And then the other thing was Einstein, who he just said that the relativity was kind of hijacked from Einstein and became a philosophy. You know, it's not with Einstein's blessing or anything. I think he actually said that Einstein did not like the fact that happened.
Because he was talking about scientific principles.
Yeah, he was talking about science, you know.
Sociology.
You know, relative speed. If I'm standing here and something's going that fast, if I'm on the thing that's going fast, then you're going the opposite direction. I mean, it's just, you know, but they took it to mean relative truth. And it took hold, and it is very much in hold now.
It's so rampant, is how you would put it.
Yeah, rampant. See, another good word. but that was a good book, Modern Times by Paul Johnson. And I've still got to read History of Christianity by Paul Johnson. You've recommended that to me.
Yeah, and I've read the first couple chapters several times and never got
it. It's huge. So the book is giant. Yeah.
Well, it is, and it's complex, and I keep going, I'll finish this later. And then,
well,
I
lucky for you, I have decided to choose. No.
Please spare me, sir. Only if we just read two chapters.
Two chapters, right.
Because the thing is that when you were just saying about Freud, Freud's way of thinking influencing us so that we think no one's responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I guess, because of that idea that you can always explain away everything that's happened, like you beat your kid because your father beat you, or that kind of thing, I guess is what you're saying.
You have a gene, you know, although Freud didn't start this, you know, the fact that we have genes that make us do things like, you know, the reason that I'm on this podcast is because I have the podcasting gene, and it's gone
just
insane,
when I talk.
Which is also a funny connection, because John Cleese has a hilarious little video on YouTube that I'll link to, John Cleese from Monty Python. That just pokes fun at the whole idea that there are genes for everything.
Oh, I can't wait to see
it. Yeah. Oh, it's terrific.
He's so great.
Yep.
well, because what that made me think of is, in that sense, this entire book is a commentary on that way of thinking, because what everybody has to overcome, except for Mark Petrie and maybe a couple other people. Oh, that one woman who's hanging stuff all over herself and all over her house because she doesn't know what's going on, but she knows something bad's happening. I can't remember what her name was. She was a minor character, but they're like, she gets it, is that whole idea of the modern intellectual, scientific way of explaining things versus, I guess, what now would be called a more superstitious way, mm-hmm. but the way of saying, well, there are things that we don't understand and we can't explain everything. And at one point, where is it that he talks about this? I thought I made a note on it, but he does talk about the fact that, oh yeah, ordinary man believes things in a way that writers don't ever understand. Oh wait, I do have it marked here. And I hadn't really thought of this as kind of a thesis for the underlying attitude of everybody in this book. Here we go. Says, so someone, darn it. He does a lot of just dialogue. And if you don't keep up with who it is, four pages later, you're very confused.
Yes, yes.
Someone has just been talking about all the things that happened to prove vampirism in other stories and documentation and all this kind of thing. And so they say, and you believe that? Matt asked. Oh, yes, says whoever this is. And I suspect most people would. The ordinary fellow isn't half so leery of the supernatural as the fiction writers like to make out. Most writers who deal in that particular subject, as a matter of fact, are more hard-headed about spirits and demons and boogies than your ordinary man in the street. Lovecraft was an atheist. Edgar Allan Poe was a sort of a half-assed transcendentalist. And Hawthorne was only conventionally religious. Oh, it's the priest who was talking. Okay. Because Matt says, well, you're amazing, like conversant on the subject.
Cool. And
the priest says, well, I was interested in all this stuff when I was young. So.
That's neat.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just looking at your website as you were reading that. I remembered that you posted two quotes on your website from this book.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, well, I'll do the second one first. Because it kind of ties in. It says, if a man dethrones God in his heart, Satan must ascend to his position.
Yeah.
Nice quote.
Which is the other theme, I guess the big theme.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. And then the other one is just a really nice piece of writing from early in the book. It had that comfortably sprung, lived-in look that library books with a lively circulation always get. Bent page corners, a dab of mustard on page 331, a whiff of some reader's spilled after-dinner whiskey on page 468. Only library books speak with such wordless eloquence of the power good stories hold over us, how good stories abide, unchanged and mutely wise, while we poor humans grow older and slower. It's gorgeous. Mm. I loved it.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
In fact, earlier I almost said, you know, the way you wrote about libraries. Because that's true. And that's the thing about a physical book and a library book. And there's a shout out for Jenny.
Yeah. Our librarian, right.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit of that book that you read that was had stuff in the margins.
Yes. S.
S, that's right.
By J.J. Abrams and somebody who actually wrote it. J.J. Abrams had the idea, as happens a lot, and somebody else did it.
That's
cool. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. So that's on happycatholic.blogspot.com.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I said that one thing about dethroning God and Satan takes that throne in your heart. That quote actually sums up, speaking of good words for it, sums up that whole concept of the modern way of thinking of things. It just leaves that hole open for what's going to come in and influence how we act. If you have no strong moral guide, and I'm not saying that people who don't believe in God can't have a strong moral guide. Heaven knows I know plenty who do, but it's harder.
Yeah.
Having been there, it's harder because it's very easy to be swayed by what other people say, and you're always having to fight your way back trying to find what's true. And I think that's the thing that influenced me the most when I was just like, how do people know if God exists? I just want to know what's true, capital T.
Yeah.
Yes or no?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. But yeah, if you know, without any kind of direction, you know, you just get swept up by everything that comes by. Again, you know, I know a lot of good people that aren't Christians or believers of anything, really.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of good people, but it just seems like my life got a lot better once I just kind of accepted that there is a truth and started to delve more. Rather than just get swept away by everything that I read. You know, certainly some people, you know, on the internet, you know, you could be a Christian at 8 a.m. and a Buddhist by noon and a, you know, a Muslim by the end of the day and an atheist by the time you go to bed.
Yeah.
You know, you could just get swept by every single thing that you read on, you know, the, I say the internet, but it could be anywhere, but
sure.
But yeah, I'm, you know, try some direction, try, I don't know. I just think it's good.
I guess, yeah, maybe that's kind of the Blaise Pascal bet of, you know, for a year, act as if God's there, think mm-hmm. and live as if God's there. Because it occurred to me while you were saying that, it's like not, and again, I know we've said this before, but it's not as if being a Christian is what I thought it was from the outside before, which is, well, now everything's easy. Oh. I don't have to worry about anything. Oh, no. I mean, I spent all day, as I mentioned to you before we started, fighting myself on wanting to be in a horrible mood and mad at everyone. Everything was everyone's fault. And then I was making notes over Salem's Lot about, and I went, oh, yeah, and the vampire stirs up grudges to make people receptive. And I was like, huh? I spent all day like that. And that's why I was fighting myself. I kept going, no, this isn't fair to them. You can't control them. You just have to, don't be mad over this. And I knew when I'd stopped to think about it, I was also throwing in 3 or 4 days worth of frustrations on other little things and letting them all accumulate against these various people or issues or whatever. And I was fighting it because I know I'm not supposed to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not have thought it so much. Believe me, it's easy to not fight it, as we all know. And but the fact when I read that, I went, oh, my gosh, whether it was my own self or just these little nudges to make me just go down that wrong path, I was giving in just as much as anybody who looks into that vampire's red eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, how wonderful is it sometimes when you just come across the right piece of scripture at the right moment?
Yeah. You know,
that happened to me today too.
Yeah,
Philippians chapter 4 verses 6 through 9. It says, have no anxiety at all, but in everything by prayer and petition with thanksgiving, make your requests known to God. Then the peace of God that surpasses all understanding will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know, I know it's funny, you know, a lot of people that aren't religious, it's hard for to explain it even, but when, you know, what this says to me is something that it's like putting your mind right. Putting things in perspective where, yeah, you know, today kind of stinks. It's definitely chaos. But in the big picture, your anxiety is not doing anyone any good. And in the big picture, it really doesn't, you know, where does this fit in the big picture? You know, probably nowhere at all. It's
nothing.
Yeah, it's nothing. It's nothing compared to everything else. So I think that perspective is very worthwhile to hold. You know, it helps in a great many ways.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's funny that thing you say about, you know, you just see the right thing at the right time, because I really hadn't thought about this in that specific way, except that I do have experience, and this is where you start to sound a little, or I start to sound a little wacko, but you know, where sometimes I will just open something up and see it, and it doesn't have to be a Bible. It can be, you know, the Salem's Lot when I'm thinking about something, and it just suddenly puts, like, it's like what, focusing the sun onto it as where it can set something on fire or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, 'cause I took that thought and I was like, oh, man. And I have to say, I immediately was like, well, I've been trying harder to talk to God like he's my buddy and he's right next to me. All right, Jesus, here we go. I am really mad. And I'm mad about this and this and this and this. And I just unloaded. And it wasn't anybody's fault, which after I got done with that, I was able to kind of see it.
Yeah.
You know, which was the value of being able to go to that friend who I know will just stand there and let me do that.
That's wonderful.
I'm not asking him to make it better. I'm not asking him to, you know, I might ask him to help me through it, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that.
It's that personal thing, you know.
Sure. Yep.
Well, wow. I believe we've just been testifying.
Yeah, for the person who's still with us, the book is really good and you should read it.
It's something Catholics don't feel comfortable with, and definitely not converted Catholics. So,
yeah,
that took a lot of effort. I'm just going to say it was sincere.
That's fantastic.
But as we all know, this book isn't popular with everyone because of the themes we've been seeing. You can see these themes.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And I have to say, it really makes me appreciate the thought that Stephen King puts into things, whether or not I'm reading his modern books or not. I feel like he's probably putting that much thought into it. Mm-hmm. And The Stand, The Shining, and Salem's Lot, as I've said before, are my three favorites. And I look at them, and he does care enough to think through the deeper implications. He does care enough to be honest with his characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't let them cheat.
Yeah, yeah. And that honesty, I think, is an excellent quality.
Yeah.
One that all writers need to have to be successful, I think.
Yeah.
Courage and honesty. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's what makes them worth reading.
Yeah. Yeah. No question.
Also, excellent stories.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you liked it. Did you? Did you give it 8 stars?
I think I must have
given
it
5. Out of 5. No, this is one of my all-time favorite books. And, you know, there were a couple of times in there where I was like, man, you know, is this going to keep 5 stars? And it did. By the end, I thought it was fantastic again.
Yeah, I have to say, I was reading it and I was going, wow, you can see this is early Stephen King. He's working with elements that you see him do in The Stand and The Shining and all this.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, man, it's a little bleaker and it's a little, the people aren't as well developed in some ways and this and that. And I was like, by the time I got done, though, I looked at it and went, but it couldn't have been those other things and been this stark, realistic look at people, good and bad, and good versus evil.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it was really just like taking a snapshot of that.
Yeah,
it was really, really well done.
Right. Yeah. I agree. Cool.
Yeah. So thank you for picking it.
Oh, you bet. It's October.
Perfect.
I love it. Have you ever read One for the Road? It's a short story in Night Shift, his collection, Night Shift.
No, I don't think I have.
It's pretty short, maybe 20 pages long, but it's a sequel in a way.
Of this?
It's not like Ben Mears and Mark Petrie. It's about a couple who lives in a town next door.
Oh.
Just down the road a piece from Salem's Lot.
I'm so sorry for
those poor folks.
In the news clippings, I was like, oh no.
Yeah, so it's a short horror story.
Okay.
And some vampires show up and stuff.
So Night Shift. Stuff and junk.
Yeah.
Okay, Night Shift. I will look for that.
You might be able to find it online somewhere, but.
Oh, yeah. I bet the library has it.
Yeah, so. It's worth a read. In fact, there's a story in that same collection called Jerusalem's Lot, which I believe is a prequel of some kind. But I remember reading it and just not really getting it. But I haven't read it in so long.
Mm.
But I read it and I was like, what is this? Maybe I would understand it now and see it like maybe it's a Bram Stoker or pastiche or something that, you know.
Maybe.
Who knows what it is. But.
Well, and I was so caught up in the Jerusalem's Lot name that I was talking to people about it. And I go, well, I was just reading Jerusalem's Lot. I mean, Salem's Lot. I was calling it the wrong name the whole time.
Yeah, that's cool.
So
cool. Well, great. So what have we got coming up now?
Let's see. Let me look
it up here. Oh, yeah. Super 8's next.
Yeah.
Monster movie.
Mm-hmm.
Old fashioned. Gotta love it.
Coming at old school, kind of like E.T. monster movie without the E.T.
Exactly right. Excellent. And then after that, a little history.
Yeah.
The Catholic Church through the ages.
Oh, thank goodness. We don't have to read Paul Johnson yet then.
No. No, I think in preparation to read that book, I better read Paul Johnson.
Oh, my. I feel like it's the other way around. I feel like I have to read this first.
And then to get ready for that. Oh,
yes.
Sounds good.
The overview.
Very cool. And then you picked a movie called Hero.
Chinese.
Excellent. Oh, that'll be fun. That'll be fun.
Oh, yeah. Martial arts, Jet Li, everyone, come on. And big themes.
I love it.
We got it.
Cool. And then In This House of Breed by Rumor Godden.
Rumor Godden.
Cool. Mm-hmm. I need to grab that. I haven't bought it yet.
That is one of my Desert Island books. She is one of the one of the most beautiful writers.
Cool. I'm excited.
Yeah.
Yep. I know nothing about it. So cool. And then I guess I'm going to have to pick a movie to go to the end of that one.
Well, you've got a little while.
I got a little while.
A month or two.
Excellent. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for reading Salem's Lot.
Well, thank you for choosing it. Mm-hmm. And thank you, everybody, for listening to us talk about the sacraments for, 45 minutes.
Oh, too funny.
And vampires.
I love it. And yeah, there was vampires in this.
Along with the sacraments.
All right. We'll see you later.
Okay. See you later. Have a good couple weeks, everyone.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.